This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Today is Dr. Martin Clemis.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about an endlessly fascinating topic today, which is the Vietnam War, but not as Americans often understand it, even today, you know, 50-odd years after it ended. So we have a view of the Vietnam War, and our view of the Vietnam War is the Vietnam War started 1964, 1965, ended 1975, and that was kind of it. So, Dr. Clemis, as we begin, how do the Vietnamese see the Vietnam War?
Okay. Well, thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. Vietnamese see the Vietnam War as just really a very small and very recent episode in a very long history, which goes back, millennia in their struggle against the former nation to achieve kind of their own national, political, and cultural identity, first via the Chinese, and then later, obviously, in the 19th century, against the French after they formally colonized and create Indochina. So it's a very recent episode in a very long history, part true, part myth-making about creating a nation, but there's no single Vietnam. There are many Vietnams, and kind of the modern kind of post-colonial Vietnam, how it achieves, independence after the French are gone and after they defeat the United States in South Vietnam in 1975 is kind of a new episode as well. So there's many different Vietnams that come together as the country slowly evolved over, as I said earlier, millennia, pushing south from southern China into northern Vietnam, the Red River Delta. So it's an important story, but it's a minor point in a much longer history.
Okay, so let's talk about some of that longer history and some of the ideologies that are involved in it. So I think you mentioned the three kind of major influences. You have this diverse group of native peoples from the Red River Delta to the south and up into the mountains. We forget Vietnam's a huge country.
Yes.
You have the Chinese, which is both an origin, because the Vietnamese people probably at some point migrated out of China.
Yes.
But also a colonial influence.
Yes.
And then you have the French colonial influence starting around 1880.
Yes.
So before we even get to the 20th century conflicts, how do those three kind of threads blend together?
Okay. Well, the three threads, they come together in the fact that Vietnamese identity evolved slowly over time. And one of the things that made them so effective in the mid-20th century against the French and the United States is that they created various different myths related to foreign invasions and occupation by outsiders, be they Chinese, be they Mongols, be they the French. But the reality is that most of Vietnamese history is, it's much more complex than that. Yes, there were periods where the Chinese had come in and occupied northern Vietnam. There was a lot of sinicization there. The Vietnamese culture and language comes, it descends from China. A lot of the cultural practices, be it Buddhism, be it filial piety, be it ancestor worship.
Or something as simple as food, too.
Yes, food, right. It's a monoculture of rice. This is the entire culture and society and politics and the family are structured around the agriculture there, which is the monoculture. That's single big crop of rice production that's very important to them. And it's true. There were times, yes, not only the Mongols, but the Chinese would come in. There were various different wars that they had fought. But the Vietnamese had always portrayed this, or I should say the Vietnamese communists or North Vietnam, had always portrayed it to the outside world as if this was just constantly, they were being kind of oppressed by the Chinese, if you will. But the reality is that at times in Vietnamese history, Vietnamese would invite them in, because Vietnam, contrary again to the myth that was perpetuated by the communists in the 1960s, was never unified. Throughout most of its history, it was not unified. There was a lot of internal political struggles, as there were in a lot of pre-kind of modern societies internally. So at times, the Chinese were actually invited in by various different warlords and powers to help them gain a leg up on their adversaries.
So this is a not uncommon thing in colonial histories. And I think what you're describing is a really important thing for listeners to understand. There is a post-colonial narrative that you have the colonists, who are usually evil, repressing the good natives, and there's no exchange there beyond the repression. But the reality, as you say, often is that the people perceived as colonizers, rightly or wrongly, are often invited by local interests, usually a power structure that wants to stay in power.
Yes. Yes. And the another myth closely related to that is the idea that the Vietnamese were constantly colonized by others. They were victims of imperialism or imperialist impulses, if you will. But in reality, they themselves were also colonizers and imperialists as well, because slowly, it took about a millennia or so, as they pushed downward from the Red River Delta until eventually by the 18th century settled the Mekong Delta in the south, they displaced and oftentimes conquered and oppressed other ethnic minorities, be they Hmong, be they Khmers, who were in those regions. Mm-hmm. So they have their own long history of imperialism, of oppressing indigenous peoples who were already there, pushing them out or killing them or assimilating them in some fashion or another. So much like the United States pushed westward from the colonies and the East Coast, the Vietnamese had a similar process pushing southward from the Red River Delta down into the Mekong Delta. So that's another kind of myth, and it's another indicator that, you know, Vietnam was never really truly unified, because there were power struggles as well too. Now, once they had actually established control over what we would identify today as Vietnam on the map, once that happened, you had a series of civil wars among the Vietnamese themselves, as different power struggles. You had the Nguyen in the south, which is a very powerful clan, the Trinh in the north, who was another powerful clan, who fought, you know, for a very long time against one another. And at one point, Vietnam was actually partitioned close to where it was in 1954 at the 17th parallel, in which the Trinh essentially occupied and controlled the north, and the Nguyen occupied the south as well. So that was also part of their kind of political identity. Yes, they wanted to be unified, but they never truly really were. And the idea that they identified as themselves as Vietnamese in a modern national sense, that's something that did not really occur until the 20th century. But that's another myth that they perpetuated, that they had a strong sense of nationalism, they were unified, but they were divided by outside powers usually, or press, and that's not the case.
Okay, so you hit a couple things, and I want to pull on both of them for a second. So you said that the communists were the ones that, the communist Vietnamese were the ones that kind of perpetuated this myth. So two questions, and they're related. The first is, when did the communist Vietnamese start becoming the communist Vietnamese? In other words, when did they come on the scene, and perhaps why?
Right.
And then the second question is, when did they start perpetuating this myth or start building this identity for themselves that they would then give to the rest of the country, so to speak?
Right. Vietnamese communism or Marxism-Leninism really starts becoming a thing in the 20th century, the earliest 20th century. The French come in, they formally colonize Indochina, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam by the mid-19th century. They rule either directly or indirectly, depending on what area of Vietnam you're talking about. But you never had really a sense of Vietnamese nationalism. I mean, even during the period prior to this, to the French formally going in there when there were French missionaries, there was always kind of sometimes indigenous rebellions against outsiders, be they French Jesuit missionaries or whoever. But once the French go in there, they're obviously pushed back, and it generates reactions, right, by the Vietnamese themselves against French authority. So there were periodic rebellions, there were periodic insurrections, but they were always easily put down by the French. But as a result of...
It's worth pointing out, as an imperial power, the French tended to brutally repress these things.
Yes.
Not just here, but all across their empire.
Okay, right. So yeah, that's the heavy hand coming down against these things. And as a result of that, having outsiders here essentially controlling the country and then violently putting down any kind of pushback against that, you started having a nascent nationalist identity. Again, it's not what we today would identify as national, but they're beginning to see, right, and kind of coalesce along racial and ethnic lines, right, against these French occupiers. So Vietnamese nationalism starts really gaining kind of steam and coalescing in the late 19th century into the 20th century. And finally, when you have individuals such as Ho Chi Minh, who embraced communism by the 1920s, as did, you know, others, they were only one of many other nationalist organizations, right? They eventually rise to the top over time, but still initially during this period, they were only one of many kind of anti-colonial movements. And that's really the animating principle beginning in the late 19th, early 20th century and beyond that animates Vietnamese politics, is that the anti-colonial struggles, be they the communist variety or the anti-communist variety, which grows up in very many places, and including in, particularly in the South.
So if I heard that right, it's basically the anti-colonial language that you're talking about that helped to give Vietnamese nationalism kind of its form, the communist form, came about almost at the same time as the Communist Party in South Vietnam, or in Vietnam, excuse me.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean...
It's part of the myth.
Yeah, Ho Chi Minh goes... that's part of, like, the reality aspect to it. Yeah,
yes.
Ho Chi Minh, he goes to Paris after World War I. He tries to seek audience with the victorious allies. They snub him, and that's kind of the thing, the final straw, which pushes him into the arms of kind of embracing Marxism-Leninism.
Now, which is very current in France at that time.
Yes, absolutely. Now, that's not the only reason. The other reason is that Lenin wrote a lot of tracts about that were anti-imperialism, because he classified imperialism as part and parcel of capitalism, the capitalist competition between states. So you want to destroy capitalism, which is the objective of Marxism-Leninism, to topple it, to create a socialist utopia or communism. First, you have to destroy imperialism as a product of that, so you have to attack imperialism. And that's a kind of message that's very receptive to Ho Chi Minh and others, Lê Duẩn, Lê Đức Thọ, who also embrace kind of the militancy of Marxism-Leninism at a young age, right, in response to the excesses of French colonialism.
So one of the tensions here within Marxism kind of writ large, it's something the French struggled with a lot, because France is fair to characterize as a largely socialist, communist-driven politics from the early 20th century, Jean Jaurès, through the 1950s. But those people are also ardent imperialists for the most part. So you have kind of a weird tension between mainline Marxism and the Leninist anti-colonialism.
Yeah.
And now mainline Marxism preaches a series of cycles where you have the bourgeoisie overthrow the nobility, and then the proletariat overthrow the bourgeoisie, and then the worker state emerge. That model doesn't really fit a colony. So how are the Vietnamese communists dealing with some of kind of the inherent contradictions, both of communism, Marxism writ large, and also the way the French practice it, which is not kind to its colonies?
Okay. Now, I don't know if it's more, if it goes ties back to just the racial aspect of it, but they're able to kind of just classify France as an imperialist occupier, right? And even though, France had a lot of, left-leaning and sometimes very left-leaning governments, they felt that there was no common cause there. For them, the first issue was always French colonialism. And the first impulse and what starts their kind of political identity was an anti-colonial identity in which Marxism-Leninism gets layered on. And although they don't completely, because people have always argued, where they were more nationalists, people like Ho Chi Minh, or they were more communists, they were both. They were able to hold these two kind of things in their mind at once, and they were able to use that and craft a narrative which blended those two aspects and play it up or downgrade it when they needed to.
So on that note, just very briefly, because France is easy, right? They're European. They look different. They speak a different language. Mm-hmm. So how do the Vietnamese communists square their relationship with the Chinese communists, who part of kind of their founding ideology is we've always been oppressed, and the first people that oppressed us were those guys up to the north?
Right. It's something else. It's again, it's a matter of expediency. And as the Cold War and this conflict becomes more ideological, they make common cause with, because China itself was beset by a civil war in which you had, you know, communist elements, Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party fighting Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. So the Vietnamese communists, or the Viet Minh, as they came to be known, later on, they made common cause with Ho Chi Minh and Chinese communists, as they did with other communists throughout the world, right? As part of the kind of the Comintern and the Soviets' project of spreading kind of communist influence throughout the world and forging contacts among people. So they were easily able to identify with either Westerners or Chinese if they were of communist kind of stripe. And Ho Chi Minh himself had spent, because he leaves, he's out of Vietnam for 30 years. He leaves in 1911, doesn't come back till 1941. He spends a large portion in China as well, forging those ties with Chinese communists.
So what you're pointing out is that there is a very strong ideological streak, but there is also a equally strong pragmatic streak.
Yes, yeah. They want independence, right? Ho Chi Minh himself says, right, probably played up for propaganda, but I believe they believed it, right? Is the idea there's nothing more precious than independence and freedom.
Yeah, so that you point out something really important, which is a thread we often lose in our modern age of cynicism. Sometimes people actually do believe the ideas they espouse, even if those ideas appear to be contradictory.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk about one of the other major ideological influences in the region, and you mentioned it earlier. What role does Buddhism play in all of this?
Okay. For the communists, not much, right? I mean, for them, it's more of a political consciousness. This is a political movement. Vietnam itself is 80% Buddhist. However, there were elements of sympathy among the Buddhist community who cooperated with Ho Chi Minh against the excesses of Diem regime once that comes into play. Mm-hmm. Catholicism itself was also an issue because, you know, Vietnam had a large Catholic population due to French colonialism and French Jesuits. But they themselves usually position themselves opposed to the Viet Minh and Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese communists as a result of the kind of anti-religious aspects of Marxism.
What about in terms of, so high politics, philosophy, yes. What about in terms of the experience of the average person in Vietnam? How did they deal with both Buddhism, traditional practices, or Catholicism, compared to these relatively newer ideas?
Okay. The most part, the Vietnamese peasants were not very much engaged in these kinds of conflicts, right? They either were Catholic or they were Buddhist. But remember, these are pre-modern societies. People, most of their identity is in, you know, also the Confucian system. Their family, their village, their local community. They're poor peasants. They're grinding out a daily existence. And oftentimes they didn't, you know, they might have been practicing Catholics or practicing Buddhists, but when it came to Western politics, such as Marxism-Leninism and or kind of capitalist democracy, that kind of went over most of their heads. They were participated, I think, based upon, in large part, just their immediate circumstances, if you will. So that one time, if the government controlled an area and they're preaching against communism and there were benefits for them, they would sometimes do that. A lot of fence sitting. They were not so much committed to these modern ideologies out of political consciousness as more as just like daily reality. I think that grew over time, definitely.
Yeah, but, and I think that's true of history from below across the board. It's, you know, the average person is concerned with how they can improve their life, not necessarily his ideologies.
Yes, and the thing is, as in most revolutions, particularly Marxist revolutions of the 20th century and maybe beyond, is that these are not, despite the propaganda that these are people's movements, they're really not, right? The people are the tools that they use, and they will smash the people when they are not a useful tool. I mean, we've seen it in Soviet Union. We've seen it with Mao. I've read a lot about him recently, just the horrors that were inflicted on the Chinese people by him. And this, so it's not a genuinely bottom-up movement. These are top-down movements by people who are ideologically driven, who are motivated, who are good organizers, and who are ruthless, and they pull the masses along oftentimes.
So on that thread, so you said that the Vietnamese communists were one nationalistic group amongst many.
Yes.
So how did they come from one amongst many to first amongst equals to basically the only one of their kind, at least in northern Vietnam, to start?
Yeah, no, right. That's a great question. Really, it's really World War II. The Japanese come in 1940. They occupy Vietnam. And what happens is that they start confiscating rice for use for the Imperial Japanese Army and it leads to mass starvation. Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh see an opportunity. They quote-unquote liberate this rice and redistribute it. So almost overnight, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh, their street cred skyrockets. And all of a sudden, they look like they're really working on behalf of the Vietnamese people. So that's one thing. They get some credibility there. But then also sheer ruthlessness, right? After 1945, when Japan surrenders, the first thing they do is start going around and killing fellow Vietnamese, right? The nationalists who were not part of the Viet Minh. And they've done the same thing repeatedly during very many different periods throughout their history. So on one hand, they did something genuine for the population to elevate their credibility in their eyes, which gave them a lot of a big boost as far as recruitment and getting people to support them. But then also just sheerly, just violently eliminating any opposition.
So in 1945, is this a fairly intellectually coherent and homogeneous organization? Like, there isn't a lot of dissent within the Vietnamese communists at this time?
Well, I mean, not the true believers. Remember, the Viet Minh is a front, and they've had many front organizations in which at times they're able to, due to whoever the enemy was, the more pressing enemy, and when France was there, it was the French, and when, for Southerners at least, when Ngo Dinh Diem and the Republic of Vietnam, he was doing his own tyrannical kind of thing, the regime. They were able to bring together, right, various different strata of society, right, peasants and workers, intellectuals and not, but then also communists as well as, anti-communists as well as communists as in a front organization. But, as I said earlier, once they achieved what they wanted to achieve and that enemy was gone, either Diem or the French, they go right back to dissolving those front groups and liquidating or just marginalizing or pushing out anybody who is not part of the
group. You have a very hardcore, homogenous group that will expand pragmatically to include anybody that is opposing the people they're currently fighting.
Yes.
But then once they've got the power, they will purge anybody that is not part of that, that does not hew to the line of that core group.
Yes, and I think that leads to the confusion, particularly over the Vietnamese Revolution and people such as Ho Chi Minh, where people are like, well, he's, a lot of Americans were duped, simply duped, that he was not truly a communist, that he was more of a nationalist first. And I think, again, he was both. But his nationalism was only one brand of nationalism that counted and that would exist in their eyes, and that was the Marxist-Leninist variation of Vietnamese nationalism.
So let's talk about, we've talked a fair amount about the 1950s period on prior podcasts. Let's talk about the period when the major struggle is against America.
Okay.
And you mentioned pretty much all of the important names. You mentioned Lê Duc Tho, Lê Duẩn, Ho Chi Minh. I think the one we're missing there is Zop.
Yep.
The kind of the architect of victory against the French. Let's start with a kind of a dumb question. How do these men get to positions of power? How do they end up where they are in the leadership?
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question. People such as Giap, Ho Chi Minh, Lê Duẩn and Lê Duc Tho, they're believers and they're activists. And the fact that, they get help, right, obviously from the Soviet Union, from the Comintern, from Chinese communists. And one thing that the communists are really good at is party building and forging, you know, good organizations. And they rise to the top in part due to just sheer willpower for some of them, ruthlessness, their ability to really recognize and play on this narrative of this is an anti-colonial resistance war, this is a war against the Americans. So really, I mean, they're educated individuals, right? They're smart individuals. Not all of them, right? Lê Duẩn really comes from more kind of a working class background. But still, I mean, they're smart enough to understand, the belief in a vanguard party and that you seize power through violent revolution. That's how you do it. So both through the carrot and the stick and their own kind of intellect, they're able to forge and kind of rise to the top. Mm-hmm. Now, people such as Ho Chi Minh and Giap, obviously, they were early in this movement. Ho Chi Minh becomes the kind of figurehead, the father or uncle, if you will, of this party who's kind of guiding it. But that changes over time because he loses power, right? By 1957, they're on the way out. What happens is that after Geneva in 54, Ho Chi Minh understands that the Vietnamese Revolution and some hardliners, people like Lê Duc Tho and Lê Duan, they want to push forward, right? We don't want to settle for half of a country. We don't want to regroup in the North, and we don't want to do these things.
So before you go too much farther, so are these guys like Lê Duan, Lê Duc Tho, Ho Chi Minh, are they all sitting around a table in Hanoi, hashing it out, or are they scattered? What is this?
They're scattered for the most part. I mean, they coalesce eventually, but they all had their own experience, particularly in the prison system. Like Lê Duc Tho and Lê Duan, they get to know each other from being in prison.
Okay.
So that's something else. They're really Southerners. They're not Northerners, right? Ho Chi Minh and Giap, they're more from the northern half of Vietnam, where Lê Duan and Lê Duc Tho are more Southerners. And that had its own issue as well, too. But it's really over time as the Viet Minh is what draws them together. Right, because while the French War is going on after World War II, Lê Duc Tho and Lê Duan are responsible for the Viet Minh efforts against the French in the South. Meanwhile, Ho Chi Minh and Giap are responsible in the North. And that's really where the war is, although it takes place throughout all of Vietnam, where essentially the big efforts are for the French, because that's where Hanoi is, that's where the Viet Minh were first got their start and were the strongest. So
we see two power factions.
Yes.
We have a northerner power faction and a southerner power faction.
Yes.
And you're saying that the northerner power faction is losing power. And I got you off right there. So why is the southerners, or why are the southerners gaining power?
Okay, well, what happens is that although you do have this kind of northern and southern faction of the Viet Minh, once after Dien Bien Phu, when France now is exiting, and you have the Geneva Conference, they all come together. But the idea is that there's pressure now to, and it's another, because there were friendly and enemy forces intermingled throughout Vietnam. And another thing to remember about the French War, it wasn't just simply the French against the Vietnamese. There were Vietnamese who worked alongside the French, right, against Vietnamese who were under Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh. So it was also another civil war within Vietnam. So part of the Geneva Accords and why they partition the country is so they can have something they called regroupment. We need to hash out in a war without fronts, friendly from enemy. So we want to take the Viet Minh supporters and you'll go north of the 17th parallel. You who were fighting against the Viet Minh, right, who for the last emperor Bao Dai in the state of Vietnam, which was an artificial, puppet state that was created by France in 1950, you will remain south of the line. And then 2 years later, you're going to have a referendum and you're going to unite the country. You're going to unify the country by referendum. So what happens is, as we know, that never happens, right? Yes, the Vietnamese communists agree to go north, the Viet Minh go north. The elections are never held. Ngo Dinh Diem emerges in the south, a virulent anti-communist, declares the Republic of Vietnam. So now you have two kind of de facto Vietnamese states, one communist in the north, one anti-communist in the south, both stating to be sovereign. Now, Ho Chi Minh agrees to this, to Geneva, right? In part because he understands, hey, listen, an independent nation, it might be only half the nation now, but that's better than maybe pushing for the whole, loaf, if you will, and losing it all. He's also under pressure by both Beijing and Moscow, who are telling him, hey, listen, you better just take this deal for now. We'll work it out later on down the road. So he does agree, because he's more of a pragmatist. He understands he doesn't want to wreck this thing. If he's willing to get some kind of independent Vietnamese state, even if it's only half the country at first, right, we'll wait the 2 years for the elections. We're going to settle for that now. Now, that angers real militants such as Lê Duc Tho and Lê Duan, who are not pragmatists. They are true ideologues, right? They are true believers. They are true revolutionaries. They feel betrayed by Ho Chi Minh. You don't make compromises with the capitalist world or imperialist world, right? You destroy it. You bury it in its own blood. So as a result, now you have this split or this faction in the Politburo. And over time, the militant faction is later on able to portray Ho Chi Minh and Giap as weak, as not doing enough to preserve the revolution in the South, right? Because Ho Chi Minh's first policy is a North First policy, which they call it. Vietnam has been at war for a very long time now. The economy, the infrastructure is wrecked. So they want to build socialism, as they use the term, right, in the North, right? Resurrect the industry, collectivize agriculture. Let's get our footing first before we start worrying about liberating the South, if we have to do that. And that's what angers the South. As a result, there's a hands-off policy with the stay-behinds in the South, and there were tens of thousands of Viet Minh who, in violation of the Geneva Accords, remained in the South to form cells. They had weapons cases and things they hid, biding their time for that armed revolution or armed struggle. Ngo Dinh Diem cracks down hard on them, and he almost completely eliminates that Southern movement. So cries about, you're allowing this revolution down here to die. And if that happens, we're going to have to start from square one. So due to discontent and anger at the moderates, Ho Chi Minh and Giap, and this North First policy, and the crackdown in the South against the Southern revolutionary movement, this is what allows those hardliners to make a play in the Politburo and gain increasingly ascendancy, because they're saying, we can't wait around, we're going to lose a revolution unless we launched armed struggle today, now. So by 1957, Lê Duẩn becomes acting party secretary, and by 1960, he is secretary of the Vietnam Workers' Party, of the Communist Party of Vietnam, so he is in firm control, and that's what's going to set the stage for the war against the United States.
Because violence of action always tends, or briefs better than nuance, right? Violence of action.
Yes, exactly, and that's the whole thing. We can't be moderate about this, or we're going to lose everything. So that's the thing that paves the way for these hardliners in the Politburo to then eventually, by 1960, they are in charge. And even though Ho Chi Minh lives for another 9 years, and Giap is still present and has a role to play in military policy, he's head of the armed forces still. They're not creating policy.
This is the Rousseau critique of revolution. You either have to have a strong hand or it becomes violent very quickly.
Okay, yes, absolutely.
So let me ask another dumb question. You've referenced the Politburo several times. Mm-hmm. What is the Politburo?
Politburo is just a collection of the top Vietnamese Worker Party members, right? Those who were calling the shots, and again, it's a mixture of moderates and hardliners. There's power sharing there. Something else, again, due to kind of more deep diving on Mao and China as well, too. There were times where he was not number one, right? I mean, yeah. I think that's part of Western myth, too, is he's the top guy from the start, and that's not the case. There's always these power struggles within these things. It's always open that there's supposed to be consensus, and you don't get to be in the Politburo atop it. You are elected to these positions, whether you're elected legitimately, whether people love you or it's coercion or machinations behind the scenes. There's always these struggles, and they take place incessantly. They almost, right, are so, always going on in some form or
so
another.
When we want to put a name on it, really what you're saying is it's a collection of names who are arguing amongst themselves behind closed doors.
Yes, and some voices have stronger sway than others do within this thing. So even though it is a deliberative body, right, really sometimes it's just people running the show. I mean, we see that in American politics as well, too. Sometimes these parties are just a question of a handful of powerful actors who are speaking on behalf of the quote-unquote party, but they're really the ones who are shaping and guiding the party.
That leads me to my next question, which is, you've referenced the party several times, and there's a party structure, and there's also a government. Right. So how does the Vietnamese Communist Party relate to the Vietnamese Communist government?
Okay. Well, the Vietnamese Workers' Party is the main party. And they're really in charge of just about everything, right? Domestic policy, foreign defense, all that stuff. So they really set the policy for all of this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. They had a southern branch called the People's Revolutionary Party, which was the same party who were not autonomous, but they were connected. They were just the southern branch of that party as well, mm-hmm. too. But really, Hanoi is dictating all things, not only in the north, right, their own domestic policies, be they economic, be they, you know, agricultural, whatever it might be, or political. They're also calling the shots for what's going on in the south and kind of guiding this movement, even though there were people who were not part of the Vietnam Workers' Party.
So are there elections in communist Vietnam? And if so, how do they work?
You know what? I don't know that deep how these elections work. They would have plenums, because, again, this is something we're learning more, but because, you know, communism by nature is just such a secretive and highly paranoid system. All these things are done very secretively. Now, you would have village elections, right? I know in the case of the People's Revolutionary Party, now the South is something I've studied a little bit more. They would have elections as well, too. But again, are they true elections? Or do they truly represent the people? Sometimes the villagers would vote for a certain person or want a certain party because they did things for them, right? Part of because they were Marxist-based, land redistribution was big among the Viet Minh. That's one thing that allowed them to gain some kind of following. Now, granted, it wasn't their land. They just took it from a bunch of wealthy landlords, Vietnamese landlords and the French. But still, this idea that they were giving the people something they never had before, which was land ownership, that's very appealing. Mm-hmm. But when push came to shove, they also made sure they had those political cadres with guns walking around to couple key assassinations will also get the people in line there. So in the South, there were kind of legitimate parties and these kind of electoral processes going on. They also had these good organizations. They would have like the Farmers Organization, who were custom tailored to agricultural people. They had the Women's Organization, which was to appeal to women. That was also a big part of their movement, is that it was more of kind of like a equality between the sexes as well, which was very appealing. They had a youth organization to propagandize and indoctrinate the youth as far as that this is the vision for creating a better Vietnam, a free, independent, prosperous kind of Vietnam. So the electoral process, again, it's not crystal clear. They're not what we, I think, identify as democracy in the West. Although, I don't know, maybe. I'm starting to...
So, but as you were kind of, I'm kind of thinking back to when you talked about they had a broad front until they had power, then they didn't need it, right?
Yes.
So is that, are we seeing that repeated? Because in the North, the Communist Party doesn't need to have all these organizations because they already kind of have it. Whereas in the South, they're still trying to build that coalition to win the fight.
Okay. Right. Well,
is that a correct way to read it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in 1954, they're still kind of finding their feet. And as pragmatists, right, Ho Chi Minh and the Politburo try liberalizing North Vietnamese society because the peasants hate collectivization because collectivization simply doesn't work. All the land that they were given, right, and the struggle against the French was now all of a sudden taken away from them. And now you got to share it with your neighbors. They don't like it. They want their own land. And now they got to be a part of these collectivist, you know, agricultural projects, which they want no part of. So there are a series of kind of insurrections, if you will, against the Hanoi government in the North. But they are violently put down. But they don't want to do this. They're uncomfortable with doing this kind of thing. So they try liberalizing, allowing more greater freedom. Critique of the government, maybe other ideas which are to come to the fore. But once people start speaking their minds and they open up, Hanoi realizes that's dangerous to us, so we have to crack down on this. So
no, not short, that opinion.
Yeah, right. A short exercise in liberalization it quickly gets reversed, and they go back to just being an authoritarian police state and just forcing the people by, you know, coercion or outright violence to do what we tell you to
do. But so, in southern Vietnam, not necessarily that.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that there. It's not a single party line. That's one thing that weakened the South Vietnamese regime is that you had so many competing political parties that were in there.
So how does the introduction of American influence, particularly American soldiers starting in the mid-60s, how does it change this perspective from the Vietnamese view?
Okay, well, it's not just a Vietnamese, it's I think a global perspective as well too. It's something that Hanoi, it does not want the United States involved. It does not want to fight the Americans. And one of the things they do, especially in 1963, is as America becomes increasingly more involved, beginning in 1950 under Truman, helping fund the state of Vietnam, which was allied with the French, but still it was an independent Vietnamese state. And then under the Eisenhower administration with growing aid and actual military advisors down there trying to train their army, the state of Vietnam, the Vietnamese army, they want to do something about this. They're unsettled and they're uncertain about this. So they want to push hard, but they're afraid. They got to walk a fine line because they don't want to draw the Americans in even harder. So in 1963, they passed something called Resolution 9. Well, I think it's end of 62 or 63, I forget. But that's a push for full kind of armed revolution in the South. They want to topple the Saigon regime, but they want to do so in a way that's quick and rapid enough to before the Americans can get involved even, you know, further. But that doesn't happen. Although they do topple Diem, Diem's assassinated, the United States does get involved. But once that happens, they're able to then shift to, you know, the narrative and propaganda in portraying the United States as a neo-imperial power who just simply here to replace France, and that the southern government, the non-communist government, the Republic of Vietnam, is a nothing more than a colonialist puppet, right? Mm-hmm. Who are at, being held, the strings being held, of course, by the United States. So it kind of crystallizes for the communist world, right? That now this is still the continuation of an anti-imperialist struggle. It's just now the imperialist power is the United States and no longer France.
How does that influence the divide you mentioned in the Politburo, where you have these moderates, the Ho Chi Minhs and the Zaps, against Les Zouan and Les Ducteaux? Does it influence that division at all?
Okay, well, no, not really. I mean, because they're still on the same page, right, that this is an anti-colonial war, right? And they rebrand it the Anti-American War of Resistance. But still, they're on the same page as far as fighting the United States, but what really the difference then, it comes down to, how do we do this? How do we fight this war? They had three classifications of war. The first one was special war, which was just when it was them, the Vietnamese communists, against the South Vietnamese, supplied by the United States. Then they envisioned limited war, right? If the United States would come in, so we'd be fighting the South and the United States combined. And then the third one was general war. That's if it became a more regional war and China and the Soviet Union actually got actively involved as well. But when it came to both the special war and limited war, it was a divide over how do we fight this and achieve our ends, right? Because they had a much more holistic understanding of war, both its intangible aspects as well as its tangible aspects.
Yeah, also, we did do a podcast on Dao Tron, so we have a really good deep dive on that.
Okay, yeah. And they understood that the politics really is what drives all of this stuff. And how do you have a proper mixture of this, you know, politics versus that? So the strategy for them was, is it going to be protracted revolutionary war, a la Mao, right, stages and these various different things, or are you going to have to somehow jumpstart the system? So that's really where the divide comes in as well, too. And what the hardliners, because they are in power, Les Zouan's vision is to, yeah, you'll do protracted war, but when you can, you're going to try to deliver a knockout blow via conventional forces who have grown, right, in size and skill and technology due to assistance from both the Soviet Union and China. So they have a fully formed, highly competent conventional force and those kind of guerrillas who are in the South operating, doing their things. So it really, the divide then is just what strategy do we take? And here again, the hardliners, they're in a driver's seat and they go for what comes to be known as a general offensive and general uprising strategy. That you will stretch out, right, through constant harassment and guerrilla warfare, the South Vietnamese and American forces, right, kind of stretch them out. Because no matter how many, at one point America had a 500,000 combat or forces there, not all combat, right, but 500,000 American troops are in South Vietnam, plus the South Vietnamese military, including territorial forces and regular forces, are almost 1 million. So 1.5 million, it's still not enough to police a relatively small state such as South Vietnam. So part of the strategy was, yeah, you do the protracted war thing with the guerrillas in the South, you stretch them out, you use your political infrastructure, that shadow government, to proselytize the people, try to discourage the soldiers, but you're going to occasionally go for knockout blows when you can do that. So this general offensive was the idea, is that you launch a general offensive by conventional forces to try to go for a knockout blow of their armed forces, the South Vietnamese military. And then the people themselves will spontaneously rise up in the South to assist that and seize the levers of power in the urban center, something that happened in 1954. Right? The Viet Minh seize power because they essentially step into a power vacuum, right, but right. That's where it happens in the city. It's this combination between violence, military force, and then just people, seizing power.
So on that note, so of course, the big example, of course, is Tet 1968.
That's another general offensive.
So let's kind of pull that apart from the North Vietnamese side of things.
Okay.
Is this everyone sitting there going, yep, it's time to go? Are there differences of opinion? Is there argument? Or is everyone sitting there going, we're ready to go?
Yeah, no, it's still along a question of debate and how do we go about doing this, right? How much of a risk do we take at this time? And remember, their patrons are, they're with them, but the levels of support from China and the Soviet Union wax and wane over time. So oftentimes they do have this pressing need. We want to need to achieve this thing pretty quickly. But no, there is argument and debate on, do we still continue this protracted war strategy, or do we do this general offensive and general uprising? There's also practical means as well, too. Once the Americans get involved, I mean, they start kicking the hell out of those conventional forces.
Right.
And one of the reasons it's been speculated why they launch, right, the Tet Offensive is because the United States and South Vietnam are making some progress, right? So they are expanding liberated areas, or I should say more and more people are in areas considered under control or government, South Vietnamese government control, and that this is not an act of desperation, but we need to shake things up, right? It's kind of stalemated in the South, much like as it was against the French. Yes, the Americans are there now, and now that they're there, we can't destroy them. There's no way we can physically push the Americans out. Meanwhile, the Americans and South Vietnamese, they understand they can't really fully eliminate the South Vietnamese, the insurgency or the North. North is hands off. So it's kind of a stalemated issue. The North still survives. This hybrid war they're fighting still survives. The insurgency in the South still survives. So the war is kind of stalemated. So the general offensive and general uprising in 68, the Tet Offensive, as we call it, was an effort to kind of shake that up a little bit.
So can you talk us through kind of just what the communist risk assessment is, if you're looking at it, say, okay, we got it, we're stalemated, but if we follow a protracted war theory, a stalemate isn't bad against an imperialist force because we can keep this going longer than they can.
Yeah.
So can you talk us through kind of what the risk assessment is and why they kind of go for it when they do?
Okay, right. Both strategies, I think, protracted war strategy or this general offensive, general uprising strategy, they're both good, right? Because they could both work. Because for them, it's a question of targeting America's political will, its will to sustain the fight. Because they knew, for them, that's a center of gravity, to use a Clausewitzian term, although I know there's a lot of debate and argument about what that exactly means. But still, for them, that was something that they could target for effect. Right? And one way of doing that was obviously killing GIs and stretching the war out, frustrating America's aims. Once America's there, they know we can't beat them, so what we can do is try at every level of escalation, just frustrate their designs, not give in to what they're trying to do, continue to fight, use our protracted hybrid approach to just simply frustrate them. So protracted war, on one hand, is something they can do. However, right, it's taking a heavy toll on them. They are losing a lot of people. There is pressure at times, depending on which party, from both China and the Soviet Union to let up a little bit. They have their own interests globally, just like the United States does.
So what you're highlighting is that although we often focus on American war weariness, right, there's also North Vietnamese war weariness.
Oh yeah, no, it's there, right? I mean, that's a risk for them as well too. They cannot continue this indefinitely, forever. They don't have nearly the resources to do that. I mean, the only reason that the lifeline they're supplying that supported them was what they were getting from Soviet Union, right, from Beijing and Moscow. So that's one strategy. But the other one was also, but you know what? That's something else that could target America's political will. If we could achieve a spectacular success or victory, if we could rapidly topple the Saigon regime quickly while killing a lot of GIs, that's something else that could maybe the straw that will break their back and they'll want to leave as well too.
So this strategy is perfectly within the realm of revolutionary warfare.
Yes.
It doesn't work. It fails in the mid-60s, it fails in 68, it fails in 72. So how do the hardliners survive that?
Well, for the first time ever, 64 is this first go-for-broke general offensive, general uprising. It fails. But they're committed, right? So they continue doing it. And they try to fight the Americans toe-to-toe for 3 years, right? They used to have this philosophy, grab their belts, right? That we are going to get up close to them. We're going to go toe-to-toe with them. And they realize they're really not getting much anywhere with that as well, too. So they go for broke again in 68. And that's really the first time where Lê Duẩn and the hardliners are really kind of chastised. They realize. So they say, okay, we're going to back off and return to protracted war strategy. Now, part of that is understanding that just the tremendous losses that the Southern, you know, insurgents suffered at this period at this time. So they realize we don't have the material means to do this anymore. Even though Tet was largely a Southern movement, they got to bide their time and be able to build that up. So there's practical reasons as well. But also, after the second failure in 68, Lê Duẩn says, okay, fine, we're going to go back to protracted war strategy, which they do for 4 years. They reconstitute and rebuild that combat power, but then they launch another one in 1972. They're also coincided with presidential elections, right?
Right.
68 and 72 as well, to try to influence that.
So who is, so we know that Lê Duẩn is kind of the front man of the aggressive faction, yep, let's call it that. Is there a front man or a face that we can put as kind of the protracted war sit back faction?
Especially after Ho Chi Minh dies.
Okay. It's still kind of, Giap is still one of those guys as well too. So Ho Chi Minh, he dies in 1969, but he really, even up to that point from I'd say 57 on for 10 years, so it's really just more of kind of a figurehead. He's the public face, right, for that information warfare kind of, you know, aspect to this conflict over time. So really, Giap is another guy. But even though Giap has a role to play in Tet as well, too. So I don't think there's still a large body of pushing for this protracted war strategy. I think after 68, and then Ho Chi Minh is still alive there, it's like, you have no choice, right? Look, you tried this twice, did not work out twice. There was, your troops were chewed up. There was no general uprising, right? And they firmly believe this. They truly believe the South Vietnamese people were chomping at the bit to overthrow the Diem regime. You know, the old adage, you know, getting high in their own supply. I mean, Hanoi was believing that a little too much. And when that didn't happen, they were kind of like, whoa, what's happening here? So they pull back. But again, they tried again in 72 and then their final one in 75.
And the 75 one does finally work.
It does finally work. Again, there's no general uprising, but they don't need it at that point. Right. They have a full first-rate military force, thanks to state-of-the-art Soviet technology. All right, by that time, Mao had triangulated with Nixon and is kind of pulling back a little bit. He's worried about his own skin and his own domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. But Soviet Union steps up and they deliver that kind of conventional coup de grace in 1975.
So we've talked largely about the communist side of this. Let's at least touch on the post-Diem South.
Okay.
What are the politics like there once the true anti-communist nationalist Diem is dead?
Okay. It's fractious, right? You have Catholic constituencies, you have Buddhist constituencies, you have a rural-urban divide, right, in which you have students and intellectuals and the educated kind of traditional old Mandarin class who are in the cities. You have a lot of different political parties. The military is involved again, too, in political activism. There's a split within the military. That's why you have the first kind of you have a number of different generals that rise to the fore early on. Van Dong Minh is one. Big Minh is an early. I forget. Nguyen Khan is another guy until he's screamed down to declare death to dictators or something like that in the streets on a tank, where he's surrounded by the public and he's kind of forced to debase himself publicly. But there's a revolving door of just poor leadership because these generals they don't have much political charge. And you kind of understand it, right? You can't. Part of the evils of imperialism is that it kind of retards natural kind of entrepreneurship and the development of true kind of political understanding and political mobilization, because these people have been, it's a paternalistic system. So once they achieve independence, they don't have a lot of skill in self-government, if you will. It's only a handful of people, right, who've had kind of experience with governing, you know, people or being in charge of you know, local government or state governments. So that's another problem. There's not a lot of skill there. But even in the military...
Some of that skill is being handily assassinated by communists as well.
Yeah, that's another thing. They become a big target, right? Yeah. Because you are that conduit, right? But even in the military, two main individuals, Key, right, and Thieu, right? They rise to the fore. Thieu is an army officer. Sorry, I'm blanking on her first names right now. And Key is an Air Force officer. And those guys are vying for power. But by 65, they are the two individuals. They're not formally elected, right? They're the ones that kind of rise to the top. But they are also rivals as well as kind of partners as well in running the government. So it's not until 1967 where they have an official election. And when Thieu wins the presidency, Key becomes his vice president. But even then, it doesn't satisfy that. So there's a lot of different political parties, a lot of different factions in the South all jockeying with one another.
So are we talking about in 67 an election, or I'm doing air quotes, an election?
I think 67 was a legitimate election. When Thieu gets reelected, and I believe it's 70 or 71, I forget what the Vietnamese constitution was, that one was accused of being fraudulent, right? Mm-hmm. That he was manipulating the system for his own benefit. But there's also a deliberative body, too. There is also kind of a parliament-type system, right? There is a deliberative body of Vietnamese. But again, that's because it's kind of like a parliamentary system. There's various different parties there, and they don't necessarily coalesce. And that's one of the things that weakens their ability to push some kind of unifying national message outside of anti-communism. And for a lot of people, that just simply didn't fly.
Yeah, you got to be for something as opposed to just against.
Exactly. So they're not able to harness that narrative which inspire and motivated people. I mean, it did enough. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it's often, I think, unfairly the South Vietnamese government and its people have been portrayed as, like, not legit or just posers, or they didn't have the mandate of heaven, or did not have the moral, you know, high ground in this conflict. And I think that's really unfair, because they fought hard, and it's particularly the military, right? As yes, they were problematic, but they fought and died in hard in large numbers against what they feared. They feared the Viet Minh and what they would do, and they truly yeah. believed in some kind of democratic people. And I think the writing is on the wall by that time. But the communist, yeah, all their talk of democracy means that one person, one vote, one time.
Right. So let's talk about kind of two aspects of this that are foreign to Vietnam, although one of them will bring us back. The United States didn't know any of this during our war there. Why not?
About this political...
All of it. About who was in charge, about all the machinations, about, you know, Vietnamese communism and nationalism. Why did we not know those things during the war we were fighting there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we knew, but I think we thought we knew better. Right? I mean, part of the friction with Diem was the idea that he was not an American puppet. He had his own visions for Vietnam. And yeah, he was an authoritarian, but so was Ho Chi Minh in the North. They were no less, right, kinder or gentler, if you will.
What one thing very quickly that you say we, can we parse who that we is?
The United, Washington, right? So we'll talk like military and policy, but the United States, right? We'll say Washington,
United States government.
Yeah, the White House and the Pentagon, let's say it that way. Yeah. U.S. government. Let's say U.S. government. I like that. Yeah, that's better.
But the reason I ask is that it important to differentiate between what the United States government knew and what was publicly available to the American public?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the American government had Vietnam was not a tabula rasa for the United States. We had some understanding because we had a lot of people, you know, interacting with that region since at least World War II. Right? The OSS goes in there. They have people like Edward Lansdale, who, you know, had a close relationship with Diem. So we had some understanding of it. But I don't know if we just simply ignored it. You know, I don't think we did. We had knowledge of it. We didn't ignore it. But I think that we felt we knew better. The U.S. government felt it knew better than the Vietnamese government. That's why we tried to push hard. And that's what one of the major created friction with Diem. He did not want to be seen as a puppet. He did not, you know, we need your aid, but we're going to create our own country. This is ours. And that caused friction. But later on, there was friction with Thieu and Nixon also had a horrible relationship. And in very many ways, we dictated the terms, and that's created a lot of friction. So I think we understood that and knew that, but we felt our model is going to, we try to impose that, I think, a little bit too much.
Mm-hmm. So the second part of this is, you know, 1973, U.S. combat forces largely gone. 1975, the communists win, they unify Vietnam, it's still a unified country. Now, in the 2020s, Vietnam is one of America's, if not closest allies, certainly better friends. That is not necessarily something you would have predicted in 1975.
Yeah.
So just briefly, how do we go from fighting a war against America to America being a friend?
Okay. Also a long process, because even by 1975, Lê Duẩn and those hardliners are in control. So once South Vietnam is defeated and Vietnam is unified under the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, the SRV, the state it is today, there's immediate, of course, bad blood between the United States. We cut off all diplomatic ties, not going to give them economic aid, and none of that stuff. But Lê Duẩn doesn't care. He's firmly now in the communist camp. And one of the things that he does immediately is throw away all the kind of economic progress that the South had made by introducing capitalist process practices, by introducing modern kind of agricultural practices, all the kind of good things that administration Western bureaucracies do, throws that away for once again Marxism, Leninism, collectivization, and it the economy craters. So he's in charge, and the hardliners remain in charge until the 1980s. So for 10 years, remember, they also fight a war against the Chinese, so they're still at war. They have the sixth largest army at that time. They fight against Pol Pot and the Cambodians. They fight against the Chinese. But they're now looking to still, again, build socialism, build communism here. So collectivization, one-party authoritarian rule, all that stuff, no democratic, you know, kind of parties allowed. It's the Marxist Party, no elections. And a lot of people in the South are uncomfortable with that, but they have no choice. So he's in charge. very strange up to that point, but he eventually does die. As soon as he dies, much like after Mao dies, right, there is a process of reform and liberalization, not only politically, well, maybe not fully political, there's still a one-party system, but some loosening up, right? But definitely economically, where they are going to adopt Western ideas, Western markets. So that happens, and from there, their economy takes off. They start using a lot of the Green Revolution technology and processes that the Americans introduce into South Vietnam. They start using those, right? Hybrid rice and all kinds of other stuff. And because they have such, they're an agricultural powerhouse, that's what helps them rebuild their economy. And it's been in takeoff mode ever since. So these reforms is what really allows them to do that. They start looking now, hey, this kind of free market stuff is working for us, even though the hardliners are still in charge. It's a single party system. They're getting old. Vietnam now is a very youthful society. They've been exposed to the benefits of the West, growing wealth, growing affluence, you know, kind of the blessings, if you want to call them, of modern technology and medicine and all this kind of stuff. And then also, of course, now that the Americans are gone, their old regional rival is there. Mm-hmm. United States is very far away from Vietnam. China is very close. Mm-hmm. So struggles with them. So we're friendlier with them. They're still a Marxist or a communist society, as is Beijing. They still have close connections militarily, economically, all that stuff. But we have closer, I think, ties due to that liberalizing tendency in Vietnam, that it's a very youthful society, and it is in very many ways looking to the West and the wealth and affluence of the West as maybe the way forward. But they still have that relationship with China, which is going to prevent them from fully saying we are friends again. And plus, remember, the war was so violent, and it left long-lasting scars like it did here in the United States. But again, because they are so youthful, most Vietnamese now are under the age of 35. They have no recollections of the war.
Yeah.
So I think they're looking to become more part of a globalist order, and that includes being friendly with the West and the United States.
Okay, so let's put a bow on this, right? Because we've covered a pretty broad swath of Vietnamese politics. So why should the average American listener care about Vietnamese communist politics or Vietnamese politics in general throughout the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s?
Okay, right. No, that's a great question. One thing is because it was, and not because I study it, but it was the most important conflict of the entire Cold War, because it's one of the things that really led to the realignment of the world order, away from Western power, more towards the East. Now, yes, China's rise has something to do with that as well, but it's really this conflict which breaks that apart. So if you're going to talk about, you know, if you believe in such things as an American empire, and I know people debate it and argue about it, but one thing is for sure is that if World War I and World War II were the death knells of European imperialism, and this kind of drift away from the West, or a shift in a global balance of power away from the West, the Cold War and this conflict, I think, did the same thing for the United States, in which it didn't destroy us, obviously, right? The United States is still a hegemon in the world. But it did move along, right, this world order away from a Western-centric world to a more global-centric world, in which smaller countries now have more and more kind of say and influence in global politics, whether it's through alliances or whatever. So it definitely plays a big role in the shift and the kind of rise of non-Western societies in a more kind of dispersed balance of power in the world. I think this really played a critical role in doing that by defeating the United States so soundly.
And specifically the communist politics in there.
Again, it's like China. Is it a true, I mean, it's no longer a Marxist society because they embrace free market reforms, right? The only Marxist aspect they're keeping is the dictatorship of the quote-unquote proletariat, which it's not. It's essentially an oligarchy, right? Much like China is an oligarchy now. Mm-hmm. So the communist aspect, in very many ways, I think it's still there as far as one-party rule and that kind of stuff. But other than that, the economic framework, maybe the cultural Marxism still exists, but mm-hmm. Economic Marxism, I don't know. I don't think it's still what we would define as communism as it was defined in the Cold War and I think understood for so long.
All right, Dr. Clemens, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.